traditionally, if you look at religious movements sort of as movements, you discover that there are prophetic voices, and that the business of the voice and the voices is interpretation. The prophet bears insight, you hear the insight, and you see things, and you do things. Okay. The business of the saint is to be the message, not speak the message, but to be the message, so that you have sometimes people called to speak, and sometimes people called to be, and you have in this section, a real somehow the prophet giving the names to the children turns the family into the message and turns the people into the message. Put it another way. I think we've seen in our time, in the last 15 years, some people have messages that render what's going on intelligible, render it intelligible and reveal the meaning of what's going on in the words. Other people say more by what they are than by what they say. We've had a period on our campuses where I think we've had more saints than prophets. Many of the things that have been said have not rendered very much intelligible, but many of the things that people have been very profound. And so I'm kind of excited about this section because it's very different from the first section, and it gets messed up with all these names and this acting out of the meaning of Yahweh. Couple of sort of background themes. The prophet Isaiah the presuppositions for Isaiah, as for the other of the Hebrew prophets, are first of all the increasing revelation and the deepening awareness of the unity of Yahweh. From being a tribal patriarchal God, one to be sure, their God to be sure, but still being one among the gods of the nations, they are beginning to perceive that the meaning and the experiences that they have in Yahweh are in fact clues to what the meaning of the whole historical process. Yahweh is not simply the Lord of Israel, he is the Lord of nations. And you will find they sort of back into this fuller conviction of the scope of Yahweh's activity. You'll find a lot of these sections in the major prophets, which are called oracles against the nations. Oracles dealing with what somebody else is going to do. Not simply what Israel is going to do, not simply what is going to happen, not simply what is Israel's responsibility. And so that they are beginning really to see Yahweh as an overarching being and meaning that ties all men together and all the nations into a single order. So that the unity and the transcendence of Yahweh are fundamental. And they happen onto this and are beginning to think out the implications of this. If you look at Exodus, for example, you can see some of the, if you look at Exodus, Israel was very, very aware that Yahweh had a mission for them. When they were in exile and they put all their stories together, they didn't start, if they had collected their scriptures, probably pre-exile, if they'd collected them earlier than that, the Bible would probably have started with Exodus. But it ends up starting with stories that relate Israel to the every other people and relate the peculiar mission and commission of Israel to the whole process to the whole history of nature, to the whole history of the natural process. And the great reorientation of consciousness that happens with the inclusion of the Genesis, the early creation stories, is that suddenly the natural order becomes part of Yahweh's history. The natural order and the whole world order, and Israel is right in the middle of this, called to interpret, to model the destiny of the creation and the world, and to preview it, and so that what began as a insight into how to become a migrant, so that the people have to get up and move from Babylon and get on the road in the patriarchal sagas, coalesces as a vision of Yahweh who provides the continuity and the meaning to the whole natural process and the historical process, and ties all of these together. The second presupposition for the prophets is that there is covenant. Yahweh and Israel are bound together into a meaningful marriage, and so that there are structures of mutual responsibility and faithfulness. So that there is not, they are not only talking about, they are talking intermittently about the undergirding process of which they are a part, and they are talking also about the covenant freedom within that process, where the people are accountable, have changes, have things to understand, have changes to make, have possibilities of both destruction and restoration. The structure, it's chapter 7:1 through 8:4, have largely to do with the Syro-Ephraimite War. Now, this is a fairly devastating sort of thing. Israel and Judah. Remember, there's a northern kingdom, Israel, capital of Samaria. Samaria falls in about 722, and this is a pretty important blow to them. Then there's the southern kingdom, Judah, with the capital in Jerusalem. Isaiah is a statesman of Judah. The Syro-Ephraimite War is a fairly complicated mess, because in this situation, the king of Samaria, or used by the more more poetic name, Ephraim, the king of Samaria and the king of Syria get together. It's almost like if the Hashemite, if the kingdom of the Jordan and Lebanon got together, or a couple more of them. So it's the two northern neighbors. And what hurts more about this whole thing is that historically, Samaria belongs with Judah. Those are both offshoots of the covenant. So Samaria is part of the covenant people, and Judah is part of the covenant, even though they can't get along. You know, they don't have a single king. There's a break back after the dynasty of Solomon, and so that the northern kingdom has charismatic kings and the southern kingdom has the dynasty of David. These two things break. But still, historically, they are peopled similarly, and they come out of the same stock, and they have basically the same faith. So here are faith brothers turning against one another, really. And so that you really have, oh, that's not big enough. You really have these two kingdoms, and then over here in what's contemporary Iraq, you have Assyria, which is a fairly major world power. And Assyria is, Isaiah is fundamentally predicting that Assyria will knock out the northern neighbors. And one of the complicated things, and in fact Assyria does, in 722 Samaria falls, but then Assyria goes on and besieges Jerusalem. There are other troubles here, so that they back off, and the southern kingdom lasts down until 585. But this is important so that you get the sense of how concretely Isaiah is involved in international relationships. These oracles are really about what's going to happen to the country and its neighbors. And I think one of the things that has, on the one hand, the theologies of history that the prophets have provided have kept Christians thinking about history and about the destiny of the world and about other nations and about politics. And on the other hand, in an era when the church and the nation are not identical, when the church and the nation, in Isaiah's time, the church and there is no church in a sense. You have a nation which has the constitution of the country is the covenant. You have sacrifices, but there isn't a people that is set down within another people. The nation is the people. And so we have to confront, in interpreting these texts, a major choice as we apply, when we get to applying them to our own situation. Are they properly addressed to America, or are they properly addressed to the church? Or are they both? Are they both? Well, let's get on with the concrete text. Most of us will want to end up with a little more spiritual messages than Isaiah gives us. So that watch yourself, you have a right. You have a right to be in a different situation than Isaiah is in. So that Isaiah may not apply to your situation. But one of the important things as we work with the text is make sure that we can tell the difference between what Isaiah is saying and our own situation. because these two situations rub against each other, and they put it another way: Scripture is not salt; is salt, not the roast beef. And there's that wonderful image in the Psalms: it's the light for the path, but not the path. So that there's some tension here. In the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but they could not conquer it. There's the story of the time in a nutshell. Most of the rest of this narrative is about the survival of Jerusalem and the struggles and response to that. When the house of David was told, Syria is in league with Ephraim, and Ephraim is the northern kingdom, his and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. There's a little bit of the poet left, you know. So even in the narrative, whether Isaiah wrote the narrative or whether one of the people in the Isaiah school put the narrative together, they couldn't escape totally the wonderful image-creating sensitivities of the prophet, that like the trees, like these marvelous, huge trees, and when the wind blows around here, even the trees do bend, you know, and like the trees bend, so the hearts of the king and the people were frightened. And one note, much of the motive of these oracles seem to be addressed to underlying fears in the community. Because finally, when you make your wrong there are some compromises which are good, but there are some compromises which are a really sellout of the tradition and the national meaning. And a good deal, the root of a good deal of dishonorable behavior is fear. You know, when you really get underneath a lot of the motives for Watergate, you get down to a kind of anxiety and a kind of paranoia that misread the situation. And so people who are afraid and countries who are afraid go to lengths of defensiveness and ruthlessness. And it's very easy not to see that. Well, maybe that's a good metaphor. The prophets are in some sense the fire alarm system, and if people listen, sometimes the situation rights itself, and some of the things that they imagine and understand don't fulfill themselves, but some of the things do. Samaria was actually destroyed, and later on Jerusalem was destroyed. The train of thought was about not only defensiveness, but also ruthlessness. Also ruthlessness comes from anxiety. There is some ruthlessness, I suppose, that roots simply in the sheer lust of power and control. But very often even that roots in a kind of fear of what will happen to you, fear of what you will lose, so that so that it's important to understand that the prophet as interpreter and the prophet as the bearer of these voices and words of Yahweh have a rather concrete message, but their general thrust is at the profound anxiety of a small country in a precarious political situation, and how we deal with our underlying fear is probably the most profound of the choices that we both make as persons and as nations. You could imagine quite a different America and quite a different world. Let's put it in a larger, you would imagine quite a different world if there really were agreements that enabled nations not to put such huge amounts into military arms. You could imagine quite a different world if the huge amounts of resources that presently go into building huge walls and huge protective systems between one country and another country no longer were built. His heart and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. And now we get into the first of the symbol names. And the Lord said to Isaiah, "Go forth to meet Ahaz, you and Shear-Jashub." And there's always a little nice little note in the Bibles that take you down. That is, "A remnant shall return." So that the son had a cheerful name, that somebody would survive. So you'd name, you know, Survival Smith. So this whole family, like the old, you know, like the wonderful Puritan family names, Comfort and Prudence and Hope and Charity. We've lost a lot of those. "You and Shea are Jashub, your son, and at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him, take heed, be quiet, do not fear, and do not let your heart be faint because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrand." So that the two, again the imagery, two kings are compared to, instead of being really huge, devastating, they're compared to smoldering stumps, giving off sparks. You know, they're on their last. It's the last gasp, and they're sitting there shaken because of this might building up on their northern border, and the oracle's putting it in a little different perspective. "Take heed and be quiet, but do not fear at the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria and the son of Remaliah. Because Syria with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah has devised evil against you." And this is what they say: "Let's go up against Judah and terrify it, and let us conquer it for ourselves and set up the son of Tabal as king in the midst of it." A lot of international relations is bluffing and power struggle, so that fear loses the day the minute it takes over. And what is needed is both foresight and courage. And then there's one little poetic Isaiah piece, Yahweh oracle: "It shall not stand and it shall not come to pass, for the head of Syria is Damascus and the head of Damascus is Rezin." And then it jumps to 9, "And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you will not believe, surely you will not be established." And so it's a very subtle, cryptic kind of suggestion that the power building up is not does not justify the anxiety and the fear. Now we come to a passage which some Christians have latched onto as very connected with being a messianic passage, connected and used to interpret Jesus. And that's easy to understand because the sign name here is Emmanuel. Imanu is the Hebrew word for near, and El is one of the Hebrew names for God. So Emmanuel means simply God is near. And this was a conviction, one of the confessions of faith of Israel, and they thought it about a lot of things that happened to them. It's a wonderful name for Jesus because Christ is, in our faith, a fundamental sign and action of God being near. But they happen to use the same name for other presences and other actions of Yahweh. And so that when you read it, it doesn't seem to be messianic. The messianic king will meet in Isaiah 9, and if you compare that to this passage, you'll find them quite different. Ask of the Lord your God, let a sign. Nothing wrong. Sometimes God gives the signs and sometimes he doesn't. But there's no harm in asking. Ask a sign of the Lord your God, let it be deep as Sheol or high as heaven. But Ahaz says, I will not ask and I will not put the Lord to the test. And he said, Hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary man that you weary my God also? There are times to get advice from Yahweh, and Ahaz is sort of keeping to himself. And then the prophet says, the Lord himself will give you a sign. A young woman shall conceive and bear a son, and he'll have another one of these names, Emmanuel, meaning God's close by, God's near, God's present. He shall eat curds and honey, when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. Okay, the child will be born, and the diet that he will have will be curds and honey. It'll be hard times. It'll be hard times. It'll be bread and water times. He will eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the age of discretion, the land before whose two kings you are in dread will be deserted. Big load today. I'll tell you, you meet more people and say goodbye to more people than you ever will in your life again. So the thrust of the passage is, on the one hand, a certain hopefulness. The children will still be born, and there will still be meaning to the lives. On the other hand, a certain hopefulness in the suggestion that before the child grows up, the enemies will be gone. And this was a terribly important oracle for them and terribly important for the Isaiah tradition because, in fact, that happened in about 722. So that Judah, for the next period of its history, was dealing directly with Assyria and then the Neo-Babylonian Empire and not simply Israel and Syria. For behold, before the child knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land before whose two kings you are in dread will be deserted. The Lord will bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house such days as have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah. He'll bring, in fact, the king of Assyria. Then there's a series of rather, the same idea is repeated, but they're marvelous images. And that day the Lord will whistle for the fly which is at the sources of the streams of Egypt, and for the bee which is in the land of the of Samaria. Now, Egypt and Assyria are the big, that's the Russia and the U.S. Those are the major powers. And the Lord's going to whistle for the little, and notice the perspective. They're the really big things that you're really afraid of, but it's the fly over there in Egypt, and the bee over there in Assyria. And they will all come and settle in the steep ravines and in the clefts and the rocks and on the thorn bushes and on all the pastures. And so these alien armies will be like a pestilence to the land. It's a curious image, because on the one hand it puts Assyria and Egypt in their place. They're looked at as something as insignificant as flies and bees, and on the other hand, they're fairly destructive, and a cloud of bees and a cloud of flies will really harass the area. And in that day, the Lord will shave with a razor which is hired beyond the river with the king of Assyria. The king of Assyria is the barber, and he'll shave the head, and he'll shave that. Everybody knew what the hair of the feet was, but they had a very nice way of talking about pubic hair that way. So they're really going to get a good shave, and it will sweep away the beard too, so that they will be. And hair was a sign of fertility and richness and prosperity, and so they're really going to be raised and razored. In that day, a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep, and because of the abundance of milk, he will eat curds, and everyone left will eat only the curds and the honey. And in that day, where there used to be 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels of silver, there'll be briars and thorns. The gardens will go back to wilderness. And with bow and arrows, men will come there, for all the land will be briars and thorns, and for all the hills which used to be hoed with a hoe, you will not come there for fear of briars and thorns, but they will become a place where cattle are let loose and where sheep tread. Grazing land. The gardens go back to grazing land and to wilderness. Then there's another sign. Malhar shal ahajbaz. The spoil speeds, the praise haste. I feel sorry for the kids. what a strong name to bear. And it looks like Isaiah's wife was a prophetess. And give it that name, because before the child knows how to say mama and papa, the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria. Damascus is the capital of Syria, and Samaria is the capital of Israel or Ephraim, will be carried away before the king. Again, keeps repeating the same theme that Assyria will destroy their enemies and in turn prove to be an enemy of its own. Because the people have refused the waters of Shiloh that flow gently, Rezin and the son of Remaliah. Therefore the Lord is bringing up against them the waters of the river, the king of Assyria and all his glory, and it will rise over its channels and go over all its banks and will sweep on into Judah. It will overflow and pass on, reaching up to the neck, and its outspread wings will fill the breadth of the land. O Emmanuel. And Emmanuel is the name given to, you will know, when the armies overrun the land, when the armies like the flood, flood the land and destroy the achievements of your neighbors, then you will know that God is near. Then you will know that God is near. Notice what the Lord, and check into 8:13, but the Lord of hosts, him you will regard as holy, let him be your fear and let him be your dread, and he will become a sanctuary and a stone of offense.
a rock of stumbling to both houses of Israel, a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Israel. And many shall stumble thereon, they shall fall and be broken, they shall be snared and taken. So Isaiah sees in Yahweh a deliverance for Judah, and he sees in Yahweh the meaning of the destruction of Syria and Israel, and he sees in Yahweh hard times for Judah. This is a major challenge of the old Deuteronomic theology. If you look in Judges, you'll find the formula that if the people obey, there's prosperity. And if there's prosperity, it means that God is with you. And here is Isaiah in a time of relative prosperity with political threats on the outside, suggesting that Yahweh reveals himself not simply in your prosperity, but in a curious way, both in some of the providences that protect, but also in destruction, also in God, when things turn around and prosperity is depressed. Oh, Emmanuel. So that there is here in these oracles what I sense as a terrible sort of tension. On the one hand, the great affirmation of God's presence and being, God's relatedness to all the created order and the historical order, which can allay our anxieties and fears and awaken the people to courage and accountability. And on the other hand, a surprising involvement of Yahweh in the limit situations of our people and our neighbors, so that one must deal with the threats to the nation and the defeat of the nation and the scarcity and the limits of the resources of the land. One must deal with the limits we face and the destructions we encounter and the depressions that we confront as not separated from Yahweh, but is also part of the working out as somehow clues to the working out of the kind of world and the kind of humanity that Yahweh intends. And so instead of sort of them crawling into their skins and operating defensively, and instead of them saying, oh, you know, Marduk's more powerful, let's change God, the people of Israel and the people of Judah are called to deal with these imponderables of suffering and war and destruction and threat with the accountability of the covenant tradition and with some kind of courage and hope. I expect, we haven't quite wrestled out our week yet, but I'm hoping that sometime this week we'll go on, maybe tomorrow morning, same time, same station, we'll go on and get into passages like 9 and look at the difference, if you have a chance, look at the difference between 8 and 9 and then jump to 11. There's a fantastic messianic passage in the beginning of 11.